This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On the podcast, Claire Dederer, book critic, essayist and reporter whose new book is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. It looks at the fairly modern dilemma many of us now face when navigating the cultural landscape amid cancel culture. How should we approach art and creative works made by those whose reputations have since gone off a cliff? Our host for this discussion is the acclaimed writer and journalist Lisa Tadeo, author of Three Women. It's a great discussion, but did you know if you're an Intelligence Squared member, you can get even more of where that came from? Head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up and you'll get the extended version of this chat, plus a ton of extra content, including our series on AI, Power Trip, ad-free listening and updates on our live events too. Or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Now let's join Lisa Tadeo and Claire Dederer in conversation.
Claire Dederer is one of my all-time favorite writers, has been for a very long time. She is the author of Love and Trouble and the New York Times best-selling memoir, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. She's a longtime contributor to the New York Times and has also written for The Atlantic, Vogue, Slate, The Nation, and New York Magazine. Her new book is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma, and it is one of the most brilliant books I have truly ever read. So, Claire, I am so truly just beyond excited to talk about this book with you. For anyone who has not read it yet, it is the, I think it's the consummate book on how to deal with artists who have not all been perfect. And I think as an artist, I can say, and Claire says it in her book too, that we are either about to be canceled, we're like one step away from being, everyone in the whole world. And I think that's the important, one important thing to sort of say at the onset. But Claire deals with people, mostly men, but also some women, and that's a whole other section that I found just absolutely captivating, of people who did kind of a little bit more than just the standard issue things that are things that kind of you can't forgive in order to consume the art, or can you? And I just think I think that it's kind of the last word on all of that, and not the last word because she gives you the answer, but the last word because she asks absolutely all the questions. There was not one question left uncovered. No, it's an encyclopedia of how to consume art. Anyway, so I'm just going to jump in. Early in the book, you present the idea of a calculator to balance the two elements, the greatness of the work against the terribleness of the crime, and with the hope that some sort of calculator might spit out a verdict that's like stream it or skip it. And I'm always thinking, I'm trying to balance that in my head a lot. The thing that I have been dealing with lately that I want your counsel on too, Claire, is my daughter, who is 8, is in love with Michael Jackson. And and it's, you know, it's just, she's loves his music. We took her to see the Broadway show, and it's a real thing. It's like, you know, my daughter doesn't know anything about any of that stuff yet, right? But she's enjoying this music, and we're here at this sort of critical point. Like, you know, it's kind of the starting off point. Do we let another whole generation and all of the ones that come to appreciate and continue to lift up something that is, you know, that we know or kind of know has caused a lot of harm to some people? So I guess I'd like you to sort of talk about that. Where do you lie on that sort of for future generations? Like, do we teach them do we kind of teach them that they can listen to something in concert with knowing what else is there, or do we shelve it completely if you, in your perfect world?
Yeah, that's kind of the question. So I just wanted to say thank you, Lisa, for being here. It's so great to see you. And thank you, Hannah and Intelligence Squared, for having me. I'm just thrilled. Future generations, it's really interesting you bring up your 8-year-old daughter, because there's this idea of innocence, mm-hmm. right? She doesn't know. And yes. The problem that most of us have with these artists is that we know their biographies, or in the case of Michael Jackson, what the accusations are, which are, you know, debated still. And we sort of can't unknow it. So it's really interesting to think about the problem from the kind of projected point of view of somebody who's innocent of this knowledge, because the fact is that this person will not be innocent of knowledge for too much longer, you know, and that's sort of the kind of a core premise of the book, is that learning about these artists' biographies is not a decision we make. Right. And that was sort of the way I first went into the problem. I was thinking about Polanski and Woody Allen, and there was this sort of immediate response when I brought up problems with their biographies, that you know, sort of various critics or points of view saying you must separate the art from the artist. And, mm-hmm. you know, the bottom line is, I'm not willfully conflating biography and artist. Right. It's just happening. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to think about it from a mother's point of view or a parent's point of view, or to put it, make that more writ large, this generation thinking about the next generation, right? I mean, because on some level, you are controlling what your daughter yeah. knows. So it makes yeah. it more complicated. I don't really believe innocence is possible in that way. I don't believe that we can consume art without knowing the maker's biographies. It's less a belief and more of an observation.
Yeah.
So I think your daughter is doomed to knowledge.
Damn.
I think that coming to knowledge is her job. And I think that people are complicated and smart and can know things and still appreciate the art. You know, I was kind of, that same word innocent came up when I was talking to an interviewer a couple months ago, and he was lamenting, I write in the book about taking my children to see a Picasso show mm-hmm. where yeah. the placards and the gallery talked about the experiences of, you know, what is frankly abuse that the women in the paintings had suffered at the hands of Picasso. And this interviewer said, wouldn't it be better if your kids could consume this art in innocence?
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, first of all, that's not going to happen. So what's the point of projecting that? But also why? Why, you know, it seems that we are able to continue to consume art and know what we know, and how much knowledge, you know, at certain points that knowledge becomes a blocker, right? It prevents you from continuing to consume the art. That's personal. That's different for each and every
right.
person.
Right.
Very long answer.
No.
Your daughter's going to find out and probably will still love. Yes.
And, you know, that's the other part of it too, that, you know, I watched Finding Neverland, and you write in the book how you, you know, you didn't want to watch it, but you kind of knew, felt you had to. It's like sort of this, you know, responsibility / obligation, and knowing that once you do, things will be irrevocably changed, maybe. And, you know, I have other people that I know that are like, well, you know, that was never those allegations, you know, here's why that might not be true. There's all of that in there too, when there isn't like an absolute conviction, right? He passed away before that stuff came, you know, before he could defend himself, that old defense. And I think, you know, that brought up another question for me, is I think also you write that, you know, you're talking about Woody Allen and Polanski, and you're like, well, Woody Allen's not as bad, whatever that means, right? Something like that. And there's that other part too, that I was so intrigued by, with the sort of calculator of it, the sort of what is bad and who is the arbiter of what is worse. And in your case, of course, you know, like you just said, oneself is the arbiter for oneself, right? But there is something interesting about that. Like, you have this a chapter on drunks and, you know, and then the chapter on women abandoning mothers. And I found myself kind of trying to, like, triangulate, like, okay, well, that's okay because it's that, and that's okay because it's that, and this is okay. And I guess, do you do calculations for yourself now with artists that you loved slash love, like Polanski? Do you calculate in that way?
No, and I mean, the calculator is a comic trope of us, of exactly what you just described, yeah, of us sort of running these numbers in our brains, yeah, and balancing this against that and so forth. And obviously, I mean, not obviously, but I think that that's not something that I was, you know, it's just so laughable is why I brought it forward, because of course we yearn, yes, for
an answer,
a rational and absolute set of values to which we can turn. I think that's, you know, that's what people want. And the book is really, you know, the sort of project of the book across its entirety is about, it's really trying to lift up subjectivity and, yeah, disrupt the idea, sorry, I hate that word, disrupt, upset the idea of authority. I don't want to be a disruptor, that's terrible. Upset the idea of authority, because I think authority is where we get into trouble with these conversations, you know, the sort of, you should separate the art from the artist, or, yeah, you should throw out every film Miramax ever made because of Harvey Weinstein's crimes. And I think that I wanted to really push past that idea of authority into, first of all, a more subjective way of valuing the art. Because if you sort of think of it as this kind of balance between, okay, well, the art is this good and the crime is this bad, mm-hmm, you know, which is sort of what the calculator is, yeah, you immediately come up against all kinds of squirreliness on both sides.
Yeah.
But really importantly, on the side of what art is important. And, you know, if we are going to sort of try to reach for an absolute, who gets to say what art is great? We immediately have a problem. Yeah. Like, if you think about Bill Cosby, you know, the Dr. Huxtable was not a formative father figure in my life. But for other people, you know, from other who've had other historical experiences, it's a very different story. So am I supposed to decide for them? Right. Yeah. So there's this sort of like, there's a way of looking at the value of the art from a more subjective point of view that acknowledges the historicity and the kind of lived cultural, racial, historical experience of the viewer, which is something I write about, you know, that I want critics to do and that critics do.
Yeah.
You know, they can foreground their own circumstances,
yeah,
to kind of contextualize their criticism. And, you know, sort of getting at the idea that the critics we often think of as authorities, that is historically has been white men, mm-hmm, don't necessarily always understand themselves as historical, culturally determined subjects, because that subjectivity has been invisible to them, right? Right? Because it's, yeah, never been framed as other. So, mm-hmm, that is one part of it, is looking at the subjectivity of how and why we care about the art. And then, of course, the criminal or the wrongdoing is in lots of cases that something criminal has not occurred. But our experience of what that person has said or done is also based in our own subjective experience. Yeah. So like, if you're a trans person and you loved Harry Potter, mm-hmm, and you are reading J.K. Rowling's or hearing J.K. Rowling's statements on trans people, your experience of the art is more likely to be disrupted because of your subjective experience. Or, right, if you've been assaulted when you learn of someone's assault. So on both sides, on the importance of the art and on the badness of the crime, there's just this incredible need to kind of back off and acknowledge subjectivity.
Yeah.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
And that's the thing about this subject, it's so rife with bringing up more questions because it's, you know, I was talking to an artist friend of mine. We were talking about Picasso and I was telling her, I was like, I'm doing this event with the author of this. You have to read this. And she's an artist. And she was like, you know, when I found out about, she grew up and grew into her art feeling like an artist's biography, a painter's biography should not have anything to do with how their painting is regarded. But in the case of Picasso, like you said at the beginning of this conversation, oftentimes, and especially lately, we aren't even going to seek out these things anymore. They are just like, you know, you took your children to that show and the placards were on the wall talking about it. It was linked like as part of the show. And that's something, because, you know, as someone who always liked knowing about what the people that I was, the writers I loved, I liked knowing about their lives, but I hadn't come up against any of the monstrousness until I was older. Like I didn't really see it or get it. But I just liked knowing where they lived, where they grew up. I was like, oh, if I live there, maybe I can write, like, you know, that old classic thing.
Right. There'll be a transmission.
Exactly. But I think it's so interesting the sort of the where we are now, we cannot, it's like, you know, with Finding Neverland, you couldn't not watch it in a sense, you know, like there is, as you say, a responsibility because it's so there. People are going to, it's just a different world now. And I think that brings up so much. It's hard to talk to other people. It's one thing to have your own feelings about something and decide and have those, but to talk to someone else about someone else, like Michael Jackson or Woody Allen, it feels like it's become that there is almost no way to just isolate the art in conversation with others, because it would almost be the wrong thing to do societally and morally today. Would you agree with that or not?
I think that some people think that it's the wrong thing to do morally. I think that there's sort of two parts of your questions. One part is, are we morally obligated to know?
Yes,
and
exactly.
The other part of the question is, are we morally obligated to then try to do some kind of willful forgetting? Or, you know, are we morally corrupt if we try to do some willful forgetting while we're consuming the art? Right. And I think the knowing is impossible not to do. I mean, I think that it's biography And the ubiquity of biography is something that is a, very much a hallmark of our era. You know, I'm 56. And when I was a kid, you're talking about knowing about writers when you were young. And when I was young, it was very hard to know about artists that you cared about, you know. And I would go to the record store and just pick out a record based on the cover. And, you know, these pieces of art would just sort of land in our feet like they'd hurtled through space. And, you know, I write in the book about my friend who would wait for a new Beatles biography to come out, like for years. He'd just like go to the bookshelf in the bookstore and look, like, did one come? And now, of course, you can know every single solitary thing about the Beatles. And this ubiquity of biography, you know, is how money is made now. Like it's what the capital of social media, of the internet is built upon, is both the biography that we're consuming, but also the biography that we're creating online. I mean, this is all monetized and it's, you know, it's ever present. So it's knowing or not knowing. I do talk in the book about feeling like I should consume Finding Neverland, but in a sense, the consumption of Finding Neverland was just a reinforcement or a restatement of something I already knew because it had already landed on my head, whether I wanted it or not. The shearing away or the kind of willful forgetting to consume the art, I mean, I personally find that impossible, and yet I'm so deeply drawn to that kind of recovered innocence. You know, I don't want to lose whatever it is, whatever piece of art. I don't want to lose Gauguin, and the looking at a Gauguin is now so complex.
Yeah.
Right. But I also think that that's, you know, I would love to have that back, but we're not going to.
Yeah.
But I think that's part, I don't write about this in the book, but I think that's part of a larger problem about consuming art that we're living in the middle of, which is our experience of art is so mediated by the conversation around it now. And I'm going to say something name droppy, but it's name droppy by accident, so it's okay. I accidentally on the street met Carrie Brownstein of Slater Kinney while I was on book tour.
Yeah.
Which was just like delightful. Yeah. And she was roaming around New York trying to find art she knew nothing about and would post nothing about so she could just look at it.
Yeah.
All she wanted to do was look at it. And wow. I think there was something, you know, that's something as I've talked about my own consumption of art, as I've been on book tour for this book, I've realized like that dream of consuming something and not thinking about what I'm going to say about it or what I've heard about it. Is something I'm that's on my mind, and I wonder if I can do it. And I'm challenging myself to do it more and more. Go to the museum and don't take a photo. Read a book and don't post about it. All that stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that's great, and I love the idea of going around, her going around trying to find something. It's just it's like the antithetical answer to what you're. It's like it's the dream of what. Yes. In the Anti-Semite, The Racist and the Problem of Time, you discuss the idea that transgressions from another time period can be more easily forgiven because we as a society simply didn't know any better at the time that the crime was committed. I'm wondering, is it just that we're such a watched people now, or do you think that things have also changed? Do you think we've evolved as a society to be a little bit more condemning of people who are not, of geniuses who are not, you know, who are not good people, or are we just more watched?
Can you say more?
Like, are we, you know, with Me Too, for example, you know, it's like, there's a sort of there's a sense that we as the female gender have decided we weren't going to take it anymore, you know, everyone sort of came together. And is it that, or is it also that are we better because we are watching ourselves? And like, you know, like if you're wandering around your house in the middle of the night, you know, like I, for example, would just like, I'll just, I'm just a mess, right? But if I think I'm being watched, I might put my hair into a slightly like lovely, messy bun. And, you know, like, but I won't do that if I'm just like an absolute gargoyle. So I guess I'm saying, are we still gargoyles? Or do you think that there's been a rise in our collective humanity?
Right. Like, so I feel like what you're asking is, does the kind of eye of Sauron yes. of internet justice make us into better people?
Exactly.
That's such a great question, Lisa. I think that it's... No, I don't think that it makes us better people. And I think it's interesting to think about how... I mean, maybe this is a novelist question, but I think it's interesting to think about how our humanity is altered by this sense of always being sort of public. You know, yeah. I think that that's a really interesting question. It's not something I deal with in this book, but maybe you should write about it. I think that's super interesting. What I do think about Me Too is that the question of justice and whether or not behavior is altered by what justice has been exacted by Me Too is sort of not in my purview. I do think that, you know, in writing this book, I think that there was an expectation. I think that when you question the kind of core idea that geniuses are bad, so we should throw out their work, there's an assumption that you are questioning it from the center or the right. I think that people thought that this book, because I had written this essay, What Do We Do With the Art of Monstrous Men, that sort of in 2017, that introduced the idea of sort of maybe we all have some monstrosity in us, and also maybe we can still consume the art. And I think that there was some there's some expectation in approaching this work that I'm going to say that it's going to somehow be in defiance of yes. Me Too. Or say that the project of Me Too has made it, you know, that has created cancel culture, and therefore cancel culture has, you know, sort of ruined all of our experiences of art. And, you know, just going back to first principles, the idea of Me Too is simply that you raise your hand and say something's wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And that is something that I do think what you're talking about, I do think the internet has facilitated that. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly it has. Yeah. There's all kinds of justice movements that the internet has facilitated and then exploited and then turned back on itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that core moment, I do think that we were able to have that moment because of this Eye of Sauron internet thing.
Yeah.
But do I think that itself, the watching, makes people better? I just can't think that human nature could change so quickly.
Yeah, no, I not so much that the watching makes them better, but that in their being, not that the watching so much makes people better, but that some sort of shift occurred with watching, plus, you know, more knowledge, plus people. I don't know. I mean, you've kind of answered my question. I just don't know. Yes. You answered my question.
I mean, it's sort of, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure it's answerable. So
yeah. Yeah. Let's go to cancel culture. Cause one of my questions was, you know, you note the harm in it. And I'm curious with, you know, you have teen children,
20 something. I've adults.
Oh, okay. Sorry. But when the Picasso was when they were in their.
Yeah. I've been writing this book for a long time.
The reason I brought up because there is, you know, the teens in my life, there's a lot, there's, you know, they are the most sort of, ready and willing to cancel and, or, you know, defend people anyway, my question is, what do you feel about cancel culture going where we are right now? Because there has been there's been a little bit of a reckoning to it and a little bit of a calming, but there also seems to be another rise happening right now. And I'm wondering what your sort of thought is now, you know, the book's been out for a little bit, how you feel about it and the reactions to it, that aspect of it.
Yeah. I personally used the term cancel culture earlier, which I never do. And I actually don't really believe in the term. I don't, when it comes up, I often sort of will just ask, well, what do you mean? I mean, it's a lot of times what gets called cancel culture is often something that someone is doing who is younger than us or has less power than us, that's asking us if we're sure what we're doing is okay.
Yeah.
And
that's a really great way of putting it.
It's, you know, it's interesting, as I've been out talking to people about this book, I do get people who are very concerned about cancel culture, and they're often parents, and they're often people whose children are teenagers or early 20s, and they're often people whose children are challenging them. And they bring me these questions in the kind of suitcase labeled cancel culture. And it's like, well, maybe if you took it out of that suitcase and just looked at it, it's actually a conversation your child is trying to have with you.
Right.
And there's sort of, I'm personally really interested in that conversation.
Yeah.
I want to know more. I want to be challenged by younger people.
Yeah.
I realize that this might not be the usual perspective, but I keep thinking of this woman who was in an audience in an unnamed American city. And she was maybe a little bit older than me. And she said, I've had it with cancel culture. I was sitting in the TV room the other day, and my 20-something child is staying with me right now. And she came in and she said, "Mom, you can't watch that. That's terrible." And you know, all I was doing was sitting there watching a movie where Fred Astaire appears in blackface. And I was like, wow, that's quite an ending to that sentence.
That
right?
is good, because I was like, I was kind of going along the whole way. And then it's like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, wow, way to end your sentence, lady. So, which was just such a, anyway, so I just, you know, sort of directed her toward this idea that, well, I mean, I didn't explode about the blackface, but I just said, you know, your kid's trying to have a conversation with you, and that's all it is. And so that is, I don't know, I'm just very skeptical of the concept of cancel culture altogether. I know maybe that's not exactly what you're asking, but that's been sort of my experience, is it's been a generational conflict of older feminists or older women often trying to understand the point of view of younger people. That's been what I've seen when I've been sort of out there.
Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and edited by Tom Hall. There's more of this discussion and a special extended edit for Intelligence Squared members. Head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up and get it all in one go, or just hit subscribe on Apple. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet.